it was over a decade ago when you explored immigration from the South with your New York-based anthology drama, La Ciudad. And so what led you back to this subject at this point in time now?
Well, I went right after La Ciudad, I went down to the border and started researching life in the borderlands. And it was really my work in New York City with immigrants that led me to go there, because everyone I worked with in New York City had a story about crossing the border that was both indelible and also, in most cases, very painful. And I wanted to see with my own eyes what it meant. And I honestly thought that I would have started a follow-up film very quickly. But what I discovered in my work on the border is that my preconceptions were false or inadequate. And I sort of had to start from zero. And that led me to several years of open-ended research, traveling back and forth across the borderlands before finally coming to terms with what I wanted to say. So the main reason, the first reason for such a long period of time, was that I realized I didn't understand, or I was repeating a narrative that wasn't necessarily true. And that narrative is the primary myth of the border itself, which says that hope is on this side of the border. You know, if you can just make it to the U.S., if you can just make it to Texas, there's a better future, the quote-unquote American dream. And when I say that that is inadequate or false, I mean it in two ways. The first is that we know that in the U.S., in Texas, in the very epicenter of the American dream, there are many, many people who feel shut out or trapped. And conversely, on the other side of the border, we know that it'd be wrong to say that it's a world without hope, and that the villages of the South are a place of just pure despair. And yet most of the films that deal with this question of immigration and the border, one way or another, indirectly or directly, contribute to this idea. So the classic narrative of migrants striving to make it across the border indirectly says that if they can make it to the north, that there's going to be this better future. And so I realized that it was inadequate and that I wanted somehow to turn the myth of the border upside down, and I began this open-ended research that took several, 2 to 3 years, traveling the full length of the border from you know the Tijuana-San Diego border to the Gulf of Mexico. And along the way, I realized that I couldn't answer. I didn't have an easy answer to a question that continually came up, which is that who was really responsible for the migration? Who's responsible for all the difficulties that migrants endure? And most painfully, who's responsible for the deaths on the border?
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time with groups that were working to, you know, find families of people who had died. I spent time with the firemen in Nuevo Laredo who pull the bodies as part of their job. They trawl the river between the two Laredos to pull bodies out. And I started trying to figure out what my answer was to the question of who's responsible for those deaths. And I saw it as a complex question. I know that every migrant every person who makes the decision to migrate is making a complex calculation. But what is not complicated is that they're coming north to work, and they're coming to work for us, in parentheses, the Americans.
Yeah.
And so it suddenly struck me as extraordinary that we Americans are almost invisible in all of these narratives around immigration. And my own film, La Ciudad, I had this experience traveling the country and hearing audiences describe their emotional response to the film and saying, those poor people. And it struck me that somehow there was this completely unjustified separation between Americans on the one hand and the new arrivals on the other, as if we were not connected. And yet we know that it is our children that they new immigrants are here to take care of, our parents that they're and grandparents that they're looking after, our homes that they're building or cleaning. And all of this is to say I made a very kind of critical decision to put an American, an Anglo-American, right in the kind of dramatic crosshairs of the story.
Yeah, I was going to... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say that's...
No, just, it's not an obvious choice. In fact, it was the most difficult choice as a writer, making a film that on one level is really about immigration and the border, to put a protagonist who's an Anglo woman. But that's where it comes out of. It comes out of a realization, not only that I wanted to turn the myth of the border upside down, but to go further than that and put a character right at the dramatic center who represents this country and who has an attitude at the beginning that she is not responsible for anything.
Yeah, because it seems that your answer is really interesting to this whole question as we opened our conversation, because it seems that it coalesces to where you've poured your own findings and research as well as the story you wanted to tell into Ashley, played by Abby Cornish, who is a mom, single mom who is, you know, having hard luck with trying to get her son back through the legal channels. And so, you know, it's her discovery is... Now it all makes sense to me, everything you've been saying to me about your own discovery of what the stories of the border are. There, it's in her character.
It is in her character. And, you know, Nathan, it's very easy. It's not, nothing is easy. I should start again. If you're telling a story that is built upon existing myths, a huge amount of work is already done for you. So, for example, you know, World War II films that are dealing with the Nazis, you don't have to spend much time to just establish the parameters of the world and the good and the bad. It's what was remarkable to me about Clint Eastwood's film Letters from Iwo Jima, that suddenly, you know, made the Japanese soldiers the human protagonist. As soon as you work to confront that myth or to change it, it's very difficult. And in this case, the one myth that I wanted to confront was, why is it that the U.S. has the monopoly on dreaming? You know, why is it that there's only the American dream? Why isn't there the Mexican dream or the Salvadoran dream? How did that come to be? What do we mean when we, as Americans, sort of just take it for granted that we are in the best of all possible places and that the future is brightest here? I live in New York City, and Hurricane Sandy came through last year, and from one minute to the next, we were turned into a city of 10 million orphans, looking at each other, holding our iPhones, wondering, what do we do next? It wasn't so obvious that we had a bright future or that we knew everything. Conversely, the idea that we have of the village, the farming villages of the South, not only in Latin America, across the global South, as being these lost places of impoverished despair is very dangerous. It's very, very dangerous from many different standpoints, but certainly from one standpoint is that all of our knowledge about the production of food still resides in those parts of the world. And the day may come when we desperately need that knowledge again. You know, the village, the rural village, preserves not only cultural diversity in terms of language and customs, but biodiversity as well. So I wanted to confront both the idea that we are in the best of all possible worlds here, in a character who actually, though she lives in the epicenter of this dream, feels completely shut out by it and betrayed by it. And then also to question the idea that the village in the South is really hopeless, in the character of a little girl who never wanted to leave, because for her, that village is a complete universe, meeting all of her needs.
Well, she knows nothing else. Also, and she also knows nothing else. That is her world, and that is, it's our idea of what is ideal that we're putting on her, I guess, we say, well, she could be having so much more, but that is her world. And like you said, she lives in it.
Yes. And exactly. And I try as a writer not to be judgmental. I mean, I really fight my own, these voices inside me that are judgmental. I don't judge, the woman who leaves her village and leaves her daughter or son behind to come to New York. I don't. I try to understand it. And I have no idea what I would make in similar circumstances. But I also don't judge the mother who decides to stay home and not make the journey. You know, the mother or father who decides not to leave their home. So what I love about the film is that these two kind of archetypal characters meet in the borderlands, but they've taken each other's dialogues. It's like the dialogues were switched in the middle of the night. So the Texas woman is saying, where I come from, we have nothing. And we're all living in boxes with no future. And the little girl from the South says, where I come from, we have a full life, an abundant world. That's part of what the film is, that I'm trying to do in the film, is to really to broaden the conversation, because it's getting, for me, the whole discussion about immigration and border is getting is actually completely misplaced. And the people who are encouraging the dialogue are themselves opposed to borders. By that I mean the large corporations. They've spent the last 30 years abolishing borders on capital. The free trade manifesto is that we should be able to move trillions of dollars of capital from any point of the world to any other instantaneously. And yet, for the human being, more borders are erected. So I want the film to push this kind of reset button. And if you think the film is going to go in one direction, it goes in another. If you expect it to be dealing with the surface violence, you're denied that. If you think it's going to be in English, it suddenly starts to become in Spanish. I'm really trying to oppose these pre-existing narratives,
and yet,
which no one film can possibly do.
Sure. And there's a great human story, of course, of the bonding between Ashley and Rosa, the young girl in the film. And I want to ask you about the two actors. First of all, about Abbie Cornish, who I think does a really terrific job as Ashley. And I think a lot of people, if they even knew her, would have known her from, I guess she was in Sucker Punch. And I doubt many people would have pegged her for this type of part based on having just seen her in that. And she really displays a weariness and a toughness and eventually warmth and sentiment towards young Rosa in the film. How did you choose her for the role? How did you get her into the part?
Yeah, well, I had seen her very first film called Somersault, an Australian production, and soon after that, a film called Candy, where she plays opposite Heath Ledger. And I was really struck by, as a very young actress, her ability to disappear into those roles. And so, as you tend to do when you're a filmmaker, you track the actors. And I then saw her in Bright Star, Jane Campion's film. And I felt that though this was obviously a great stretch, that she had the qualities to pull it off. And I met with a number of actors, not only with Abbie. But what was interesting in my meeting with Abbie was that she was the only actress who said to me, I don't just want to memorize the Spanish language dialogues. I want to learn the language. Mm-hmm. I want to learn it as best as I can. I want to be able to step off the set in Mexico and continue speaking with Rosa and her family. And it struck me that she was prepared to make this awesome commitment, and that's the reason that I the decision was easy for me. I really feel that she has been in films like Sucker Punch. She's going to be in the new film, the new RoboCop, but she's deeply interested in pushing herself with these very complex dramatic roles. And she had a huge amount of preparation to do once she had taken the role, not only learning Spanish, but learning a Spanish that is learned not in school and not through Rosetta Stone, but is learned by growing up in South Texas. And so we worked very closely with a lot of audio tapes that I recorded with Anglo women in South Texas who spoke Spanish as a second language, either because they had a Mexican boyfriend or they'd gone to, you know, they'd grown up in a community that had a lot of Spanish speakers. Eventually recorded the dialogues by those women that provided some reference. In any event, Abby had a huge amount of work to do once she was chosen. With Rosa, little Maritza Santiago, the work was in finding her, because once I'd found Maritza, she had very little work to do. She really is the girl that you see in the film. Her personality and mannerisms are what you see in the film. So the work was finding her, and that was complicated. That was a long process for me of meeting with thousands, literally thousands of girls all throughout Oaxaca's Central Valleys, and having to earn trust as an American filmmaker in Oaxaca, which, as you know, is a southern Mexican state, very indigenous. The communities are quite closed and protective. So it was a long process of earning their trust. I had moved to Oaxaca and was living there, and so it helped that that it was my home when I was searching for Rosa.
Mm-hmm. And how old was she during filming?
She was 8 when we were filming.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's remarkable.
But she's very little for her age. I mean, she's a little compact firecracker of a girl. I'll tell you an anecdote. Most of the vast majority of the girls that I met, I would build trust. I would spend time earning the trust of school group, the school committees, to be able to sit in classrooms, and then I would observe girls. And the girls that seemed the most feisty and had the right look, I would invite to a casting. But invariably, they would become extremely shy when put in front of a camera or just faced with meeting with me one-on-one. But little Maritza, the very first time I met her, just she burst out laughing at her own joke. She looked at me. I'm very tall. I'm 6'4". My hair is sort of funny looking, I suppose. And she just asked me if I worked for the circus, and because I was so tall, and just started cracking up at her own joke. And I knew immediately that she would not be, you know, shy, that she would be, if she had the other qualities we needed, she'd be perfect for the role.
I imagine that you've shown the picture to a variety of audiences since you closed up production on it and had it finished. And I was wondering, what are the reactions you get, different reactions you get from, say, showing it at a festival audience in America versus perhaps showing it to an audience in Mexico, which I assume you probably have?
Yeah, it's a great question. The reactions are very, very different. In the United States, the reactions, I've now been lucky enough to travel with the film, and I've been able to talk with audiences in perhaps 15 or 20 cities. And the reactions, whether they are Anglo or whether they're Mexican immigrant, generally tends to be a sense of hopefulness about the possibility that we can learn and grow the way that Ashley has, and people, you know, connecting to the story. Women responding very strongly to the story about as a story about mothering, and a woman's kind of coming to her own self-awakening. In Mexico, the response has been to see that the relationship between Ashley and Rosa really is emblematic of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. And they, over and over, I heard this, that someone get up at a screening and say that they thanked me for making a film that that showed the true relationship between our countries. The U.S., bigger, meaner, and ignorant, battling and uncaring about Mexico, littler and in far worse circumstances, but with the possibility that it can change. This is how they, I mean, it was a shock to me, Nathan, honestly, the first time it was, the film was distilled to such a crude metaphor. But it, I then heard it over and over again, and the very strong embrace for the film in Mexico, I think, comes from seeing a film in which Mexico and the Mexican characters are not portrayed as desperate and helpless, but actually with having a sense of pride about where they come from, and that the American character and America in their eyes as a place that is open to actually learning, listening, changing. So very different responses.
And the American character also kind of having a little bit of a hole in her soul, I think, and then eventually finds something at the end of the picture.
Yes, yes. The American is really has an attitude at the beginning of what I describe as being a victim, which is not unfamiliar. I myself know the feeling where you blame everyone else for your circumstances, but never really own up to your own responsibility for your circumstances. Ashley is very much like that. So the hole that you describe is exactly that. And the film, for her, is a journey she would not normally take. In fact, she only takes it because of extreme circumstances in the plot. But it leads her to come to a place where she can look in the mirror and look at herself and see that she is a part of her circumstances and that they're connected, and that offers the possibility for a brighter future for her, to put it in simple terms. You know, that if you actually recognize what the problem is that you face, there's the possibility of changing it.